That message was directed from the other side and not at all impelled by me. Someday perhaps John Henderson may write a book, he should, and if he tells about this occurrence many people will probably say, well, I never. I wouldn't like such things to happen to me. Hi, Gov, said Miss Taddy, jerking to a full awake after being soundly and noisily asleep for some time. I've got a question which any human would like answered. All right, Tay Dykens, what is it? So Miss Tay Dykens sat down and folded her arms and said, well, it's like this, we cats know what arrangements are made on the other side. But why don't you tell humans how they plan their life on Earth? Personally I thought I had dealt with that ad nauseam. And I don't want Buttercup to come jumping at me telling me that I am repeating myself, and after writing so much about suicide it might be something akin to suicide if I start up again writing about life after death, so perhaps I can get over it by calling this answer life before birth. On the other side of this life an entity has decided that he or she must go to school again to take a special course. Perhaps certain lessons were learned previously and the return home has enabled those lessons to be digested and weaknesses to be perceived. So then the entity who is he or she, sits down and thinks things over. On Earth many students discuss their future with a counselor, they discuss what courses are required in order that they shall obtain a certain qualification. For example, a nurse in England wants to become a surgeon, obviously she has some knowledge of anatomy. So what does she need in order to enter medical school? She discusses what she has to do, and then goes to it. In the same way are he or she on the other side of life on Earth decides with considerable help what lessons have to be learned, what tasks have to be surmounted, and what difficulties have to be endured. Then the whole thing is planned very carefully. Do you play chess? Well, if you do you will know all about those chess problems which appear in certain magazines. The chessboard is all set up with pawns and knights and rooks, and all that, in certain predetermined positions. You, poor soul, have to think and think until your brain nearly cracks and work out a way in which to win that game. It's something like that in planning the life to come. All the obstacles are set up, all the conditions are laid down, what do you have to learn? Do you have to learn poverty and how to overcome it? It's no good going to a rich family, then. Is it? Do you have to learn how to be generous to others, how to handle money? Then it's no good going to a poor family, is it? You have to decide what you want to learn, you have to decide what sort of family will best meet your requirements. Are you coming to a tradesman's family or to a professional family? Or are you coming as one of a noble family? It all depends, you know. It's like actors on a stage. An actor may be a king in one play and a beggar in another, and it's just the same with life, it depends on what you have to learn. You come to the station, to the conditions, to the difficulties, to the problems and obstacles which you yourself have decided upon. Before you come you set up your problems in very much the same manner as a chess problem is set up and then left for someone else to solve. So you have your problems set up in front of you. And instead of just sitting down and scratching your head, and anywhere else which is troubling you at that moment, and trying to work it out, you do something about it. You look about and find the family, the country, the locality which will best enable you to live the problems which you have set up and solve them by the mere act of your living and enduring the difficulties and tests. After all, a student perhaps going to a postgraduate course, he knows he is going to have some hardships. He knows he has to get a certain percentage of marks otherwise he won't pass, otherwise he's got to come back again. He knows that he'll have to serve a certain time in the classrooms, but he knows all these things and he wants to go through it because he wants the qualifications or the knowledge that comes after. So you planned everything, but none of your plans ever included suicide. If you commit suicide, then it means you are a dropout, it means you failed. And if a person is a dropout it means he can't advance through lack of qualification and through lack of intestinal fortitude. Always without any exception those who drop out of life through suicide come back and start all over again with a fresh bunch of problems just tagged on for luck. Next time you look in some newspaper or in some magazine, and you see a chess problem all set up so nicely on the black and white squares a print. Well, just remember you set up problems like that for yourself before you came to this earth. How are you solving them? Are you making out all right? Do not be disheartened, you started it, you know. Chapter 5. 100 men may make a camp, it takes a woman to make a home. TSK, TSK, said the old man to Miss Cleo, who was sitting admiring the sunshine coming in through a parting of the curtains. She turned her head wisely and gazed through those beautiful blue eyes. TSK, TSK, he repeated as if enjoying the sound. I wish I were a rich author, he said, and had an extensive reference library. Do you know how many books I have, Cle? The old man turned his head and looked at the only books he possessed, a dictionary, a diabetic's manual, a medical handbook for ship's captains, a book about countries' flags, a PS catalogue about radio stuff from Montreal, a Canadian type catalogue from Toronto, and, of course, a very large atlas, so large that it just about takes two men and a dog to lift the thing. It's certainly an atlas too large and too heavy for a poor wretch confined to bed. And that's all this author's library, Cle, said the old man with a dry laugh. Rather a pity, though, because the number of things people ask, well, it would be enough to make my hair stand on end if I weren't bald. Still, this is wasting time. We have to get on with our book, Miss Cle, and you and Taddy can go and enjoy the sunshine while I work for the daily bread. Mrs. Sook, our old friend Valeria Sook, asks about sleep. Good gracious me, Mrs. Sook, don't you know what sleep is? Anyway, quite a number of people have asked the same thing, so let's see what we can do about it. On the physical plane, a body works and builds up a lot of toxins, a lot of poisons accumulate in the muscles. When we work too hard at a given task using the same muscles, cries towels form in the muscular tissue and, being wretchedly sharp things, they dig in when we continue moving and make us feel stiff, so we soon stop moving. All the organs of the body get suffused with toxins, and so after a time it is necessary for man to lie down and go to sleep so that the body mechanism slows down, becomes almost static, and during that period of sleep the toxins which cause tiredness and muscular stiffness dissipate or disperse so that when we wake up we are as good as new. All the stiffness has gone, all the aches and pains have gone, and people feel very refreshed, at least they do if they go to bed early enough and get enough rest. Otherwise if people have been out drinking they have overloaded the body mechanism badly and they suffer from a hangover. But we are not discussing drunks and their ilk, we are discussing your attitude towards sleep, you, the sensible people. So on the ordinary physical plane, when we sleep it is with the purpose of dissipating toxins and crystals which make one sluggish, tired, and full of aches and pains. But there is more to sleep than this. Just as school children go home at the end of the school day, so does the human psyche have to go home at frequent intervals. If a human had to stay completely awake all the time, he would find life insupportable. All manner of strange physical manifestations would occur. So he goes into a period of sleep to the astral world for recuperation. Think of school children who had to stay in class for 24 hours a day. Well, of course, they couldn't do it. But supposing they had to, soon they would not be able to learn anything, soon they would be completely insane with fatigue. The same with adults. During sleep the physical body is left prone upon a bed, most times it's upon a bed, anyhow, enough times in fact for us to say prone upon a bed. At such times the physical body is resting there and just sleeping off the effects of existing for yet another day. The driver of the body, the psyche, is away. So the body mechanism called the subconscious takes over, and all sorts of reflex actions occur in the body. Often the eyes will roll behind shut eyelids, often the body will gasp and groan or snort, and there is much threshing about because the body exercises a certain amount during sleep in order that crystals and toxins may be dispersed and dissipated more rapidly. That is why people are moving quite a lot when they are asleep, and no one ever stays completely immobile during sleep. If they did, they would have a fresh load of toxins at the point of contact between the body and the bed, because all the time the same flesh would be compressed. The subconscious during this sleep period is completely freed from the control of the psyche, and so it, in effect, wanders among the memory file cards, something like an idiot boy who can grasp a file card here, or perhaps two or three file cards there. If one card only is picked, and remember that we should have put card in quotes to show that it's not really a card, but we are just using a symbolic item. If you like, we could, to make it clearer, say that a memory cluster is tapped. If that memory cluster, then, is tapped, we get a dream which can be quite clear about one specific event. But if two or three memory clusters, let's call them cards and have done with it, are picked, then the dream becomes a fantasy because, purely as an illustration, we can have a dream or adventure in which a fish is riding down the road on horseback because the memory picked up may have been of a big fish, and then superimposed upon it will be the memory of a person on horseback. If these two memory cards are superimposed, then we get the distorted impression of a fish on horseback. If you go in for slide projection with 35mm transparent eyes, you will know that you can get a very clear picture by having just one slide in your projector, but if you stick in two slides, then you get something which never happened. You get one picture superimposed on the other. And if you get three slides in, well, then you get confusion. It's the same with your dreams. The dream is a simple thing, just an ordinary straightforward memory, but when it becomes tinged or overpowered with a different memory card, then you get fantasy or even nightmare. You dream of things which are quite impossible, things which could never happen, and then if you have retained any control of your memory when your psyche returns to the body, you will say that you had a nightmare. During sleep, when the psyche is away, the built-in sensor of the body also is sleeping, and so some of the memories or fantasies may be erotic or sadistic, and so we get those terrible dreams of which people sometimes write in and say, "Gee, whatever happened to me?" It is impossible to confuse astral travel with dreams or nightmares, because in dreams there is nearly always some inconsistency, some improbability. There is always some element which is at variance with what you know to be fact. The colors may be wrong, or you may, for example, see a person with the head of a tiger. It can be determined, with a little practice, that which is a dream and that which is astral travel. Memories of dreams and memories of astral travel follow the same path into one's awareness when one is awake. When the psyche comes back and the body awakens, it may say, "Oh, I had a terrible dream last night." Or if the person has training and knows how to astral travel consciously, then he comes back with a complete knowledge of all he has done. The body is still rested, the toxins are still dispersed, but the psyche has retained the information of what happened in the astral world. Some school children have a holiday and they are so excited at coming back to school that everything that happened during the holiday completely disappears from their brains or from their memories, and in just the same way, people coming back from astral travel may forget completely all that happened in the excitement of starting another day. It cannot be too often repeated that if one wants to remember astral travel, then one just simply must say to oneself three times before going to sleep, "I will sleep soundly and restfully, and in the morning I will be aware of all that I have done in the astral." Repeat that three times before going to sleep, and if you really think what you are saying, and if you really mean what you are saying, then you will remember when you awaken. There is nothing magical about it, it's just getting through to a rather stupid subconscious and saying, in effect, "Hey bud, you've got to keep alert tonight. No playing about and gumming up the works with my memories. You keep out of the way, ready for a fresh load of memories when I return." Of course, the person who is trained in astral travel can astral travel when he is fully awake. It is quite usual for the trained person to sit down in a chair, clasp his hands and put his feet close together, and then just close his eyes. He can then will himself to leave the body and go anywhere and stay fully conscious during the whole period of astral travel, so that when the astral body rejoins the physical body, there is brought back a completely retained memory of all that happened. That takes practice, of course, and a bit of self-discipline, It is not difficult to train oneself to remember all that happened when the body is asleep. You just have to tell your subconscious to shut up exactly as you tell an unruly schoolboy to shut up. The first telling is more or less a waste of time, at the second telling the subconscious jumps to awareness, and with the third telling it is hoped that the command sinks in and the subconscious will obey. But if you do this for a few nights, you will find that the subconscious does obey. Many people like to keep a notebook and pencil by their bedside so that immediately upon awakening in the morning the knowledge of what happened in the night can be written down. Otherwise, with the press and turmoil of modern living, there is a great tendency to forget what happened. A poor fellow will awaken, for example, and think he is going to be late for work, and then next he will wonder if his wife is in a good temper and will get his breakfast or if he will have to go without. So with things like that on his mind, he is not much in a mood to remember what happened in the night. So make a definite practice, keep a notebook and pencil by your bedside, and the very first thing you do when you awaken, write down immediately everything you remember of the night. With practice you will find it's easy, and with a bit more practice you won't need your notebook and your pencil. You will carry out your days on earth with much more contentment, knowing that this is just a hard school and nothing more, knowing that at the end of the school term you will be able to return home. Of late there seems to have been a rash of advertisements from all sorts of firms who purport to teach one sleep learning. They want to sell one expensive gizmos and even more expensive taped courses complete with time switch, headphones, under the pillow speaker, and what have you. Now it is quite impossible for anyone to learn anything worthwhile while asleep. To start with, the driver of the body is away, and all that is left is a sort of crummy caretaker called subconscious, and very extensive researches in the leading countries of the world have proved beyond doubt that sleep learning is not possible. It doesn't work. If you stay awake, that is, if you are slow in going to sleep, then you may pick up a few snatches of conversation from the tapes. But there is no easy way of learning. You can't press a button and say, "Hey presto," to a machine, because that will not make you a genius overnight. Instead, it will interrupt your sleep rhythm and make you a bad-tempered, unmentionable you-know-what. Suppose you leave your car in the garage while you go in your house to have your buttered beans on toast, or whatever it is that you have before going to bed. Well, you would be quite a bit of an optimist in thinking your car was going to learn through tapes while you were away from it. The car manufacturers admittedly make several lurid and impossible claims for their mechanized tin boxes. "No, I do not have a car," but even the most optimistic of car advertisers would balk at saying their cars would learn during the owner's sleep. Your body is just a vehicle whereby your overself can gain some experience on Earth and on a few other assorted planets, so don't give yourself a lot of airs about how clever you are, how important you are, and all that, because when it comes down to brass tacks or whatever standard of value you want to use, you are just a lump of protoplasm which is driven around by day by an owner who happens to be your overself. You can liken it to the Irish man and his donkey. The donkey stays in the stable by night, but no amount of tapes will enable the donkey to speak English or even American, yet during the day the owner can be taught to learn, even American. It might be worth trying to teach an Irishman Welsh one day to see if that can be done. I think actually I deserve a medal for pointing out to you some of these things which are designed to take your hard-earned money from you. Always think, what's behind the advertisement? Well, obviously, the advertiser wants to get your money. It reminds me of the people who advertise how to make a million in, say, 3 easy lessons, or how to forecast the Irish sweepstake and win the first prize. If these people who could do such things did them, then they wouldn't bother to advertise, would they? And if they can't do it, well, they have to make money in some other way, by pretending that they can make millions in a month. They can if enough people reply to their advertisements, but don't you be one of them. Button up your pocket, keep your hand bag shut, keep your mouth shut too, and your ears wide open. Oh glory be, and all the rest of it. Now here's a question, you'd better get ready to read this carefully. You say the subconscious is stupid, yet in chapters of life it is said to be very, very intelligent, It seems to be more intelligent than the part of us you say is 1/10 conscious. Now, tell us straight out, is it stupid or is it super intelligent? If we are going down into basics again, like this, then we have to say that the subconscious is neither intelligent nor unintelligent because it doesn't have intelligence, it's a different sort of thing altogether. The subconscious is just a repository of knowledge, good knowledge, bad knowledge. It's just a filing system. It contains all you have ever heard, all you have ever seen, all you have ever experienced. It reminds your automatic responses when to breathe in and when to breathe out. It reminds part of you to wriggle and screech if you are tickled, etc. It's just an automatic reminder. Would you say that a librarian is intelligent? Well, that's a matter of opinion, of course. I know I tried to deal with those silly librarians at a famous library in London, the ones who put down details, and I tried to tell these people that the details they were putting down about me were utterly and incontrovertibly incorrect, but it's such a job convincing some of them, and I am left with the indelible opinion that the record library librarians at that famous library are not intelligent. Anyway, that's a matter of opinion. But let us make that query again just for the sake of answering this question: would you consider that a librarian was a genius? Would you consider that a librarian could answer any question about anything and say what any person has said before? Well, of course you couldn't, not even if you were a librarian yourself could you make such claims. Instead you would say, quite correctly, that, no, there is no such knowledge in a conscious human. But a librarian knows where to find certain information. The best librarians are those who can find the information fastest. You and I could go to a library and fumble our way through certain filing cabinets in search of a book title containing matter on the subject of interest. Then we would find we had to refer to something else, then we would find that the book was out of print or out of circulation or out of the library. We would waste half a day or more. Yet by asking a librarian there is a second during which he has an absolutely blank expression, and then the penny seems to drop with a clank, and he or she gets into motion and produces the book with the desired information. If he or she is good at the work, they recommend many more books. The subconscious is like that. As soon as the thinking we desires to know something, then the subconscious tries to come up with the answer, that is not intelligence. That is entirely automatic, and as it's automatic it can be trained. Trained for what? Well, the answer is simple. Your subconscious is your memory. If you have a poor memory it means that your conscious 1/10 is not getting through to your subconscious 9/10. If you have a poor memory it means that the subconscious is falling down on the job of providing you the information which you demand. Supposing you want to know what Gladstone really said back in the year 18-something or other. Well, you've probably heard it, you've probably read of it, so it's in your memory and if your subconscious cannot bring it out it means that there is a fault in a relay somewhere. Some people can reel off a terrible lot of stuff about football or baseball teams, and give all the winners or whatever they are called for years back, but that is because they are interested in the subject. And people cannot remember things in which they are not interested. Never having seen a football match or a baseball match, and not wanting to, I haven't the vaguest idea about it. I thought that a baseball diamond, for instance, was a thing given to prize winners. No doubt somebody will write in to tell me differently. If you want to cultivate a good memory, then you have to cultivate your subconscious. You have to be interested in a subject. Until you are interested the subconscious cannot tag on. Many of our lady readers will know all about the male film star, how many times he has been married, how many times he has been divorced, and how many times he has chased his beloved for the moment around the world. That's easy, they can do that. But just ask them to go and get a standard fine thread from a local shop, perhaps a 3/16 standard fine thread, and they'll come back looking blanker than usual. To train your memory, that is, to train your subconscious, you should think clearly about things and assume an interest in those things. If men are sent shopping for women's things, well, they come back without a single thought in their heads, but if they took an interest in things then their memory would improve. One can take an interest by asking oneself why a woman wants this, or that, or something else, and the woman can ask herself why a man should want, for instance, a 3/16 bolt of fine thread. If she can get a definite interest, then he or she can remember. If you are trying to remember something specific such as a telephone number, then try to imagine the person to whom the telephone number belongs, or if you do not know the person or cannot visualize him or her, then look at the telephone number. Is it a series of circles or a lot of strokes? For example, sixes, nines, zeros become circles, as do threes and twos. But strokes would be ones, sevens, etc., and, of course, fours. So if you can visualize a number by circles or strokes, you can remember it. The best way is to use our old system of threes. Repeat the telephone number three times, while holding the sincere conviction that you will always remember that number. You can, you know, it's quite easy, nothing difficult in it. Another thing which can be done during the period of sleep is to approach another person whom one desires to influence. Now, sleep learning is useless, that is absolutely a waste of time because you are trying to teach the body something when the entity that controls the body is out of the body. But let us deal with something else, influencing others. Supposing that Mr. John Brown very much desires to get an appointment with the firm of Versailles Manufacturing Company. Mr. Brown has heard that this company is an extremely good company and that it is definitely desirable to be employed by such a firm. Mr. Brown has had some good fortune in getting an appointment with the personnel manager or someone else in authority for, say, the following day. Now, if Mr. Brown really wants to sell himself, this is what he will do. He will get hold of any information he can about the firm and especially about the person with whom he has the interview. That means that Mr. Brown must make a definite inquiry as to who will do the interviewing. Then if it is at all possible, he will get a photograph of the interviewer, and before going to bed that night Mr. Brown will sit quite alone and he will visualize himself talking to the interviewer on the morrow. Mr. Brown will convincingly state, in the privacy of his bedroom, the reasons why he would be a desirable employee, the reasons why he needs that particular appointment, the reasons why he considers he is worth more than the firm normally pays. He says all this to the photograph. Then he lifts up his feet and tucks them in bed, and he puts the photograph so that it is facing him as he lies on his accustomed side. Mr. Brown goes to sleep with the firm, very definite, very emphatic intention of getting out of his body and journeying to Mr. Interviewer's house. There he will meet Mr. Interviewer out of his body, and Mr. Brown's astral will tell Mr. Interviewer's astral all that Mr. Brown has just said in the privacy of his bedroom. Fantastic? Daft? Don't you believe it? This really works. If the interviewee, I hope that is right, it means the one who is going to be interviewed, plays his cards properly, then the interviewer will give him the job. That is sure, that is definite, it really works. Now, you who want a better job or more money, go through those words again and put them into practice. You can influence people in this way, but not necessarily for bad. You cannot influence a person to do that which he or she would not normally do, that is, you cannot influence a person to do an evil or wrong act, which means that some of you fellows who write into me asking how to get power over girls, well, you can't friend, you can't, and don't try. Yes, innocent readers, ladies of high degree and of the utmost purity, I sometimes get letters from gentlemen who ask me to teach them to hypnotize girls or to put spells on girls or to produce the formula of something which will render girls helpless so that the gentleman, well, what would he do under such circumstances? Anyway, I tell them the truth, which is that unless they go in for poisoning they cannot influence another person to do that which the other person's conscience would not normally permit. So there you are. If your desires are pure or clean, then you can influence others. You can influence others to do good but not to do bad. Most people don't need influencing to do bad anyhow, it seems to come natural. It might be as well here to introduce a question having bearing on some of the remarks made in previous chapters. The question is, You say that people come to this earth time after time until the person concerned does his specific task. You also say that at times groups of people come for the same purpose. Can you give any definite illustration on that point?
As a matter of fact, yes, quite definitely, yes.